I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. It is hot, it's sweaty, it's the time of year that everyone says they love, but then you peel yourself out of a chair and you're wondering, wait, why do I like the summer? Oh yeah, cookouts. That's why you love the summer. And that's what our show's about this week. We're gonna talk about Korean barbecue sauce with the chef Bill Kim, the pleasures of grilling little fish with the Portuguese chef Nuno Mendes, and the pros at America's Test Kitchen are gonna give us the whole how not to do it wrong primer. But first, we're gonna start with maybe the best part of any cookout, the sides. Bon Appetit magazine had a feature in their June-July issue on some killer make-ahead dishes, so we talked our way into their beautiful test kitchen high up in the World Trade Center to see a few of those recipes in action. And they had a corner full of jars of fermentation projects, and cooks already developing their winter holiday recipes, and Claire Saffitz had me pounding the table when she turned me from a hater to a believer in a cookout classic. So hi, Claire. Thank you so much for having us here in the beautiful Bon Appetit Test Kitchen.
My pleasure.
So the first thing I want to talk to you about is pasta salad.
Yeah, I'm nervous about this part.
Don't be nervous. Okay, I have to tell you, I feel like pasta salad, I should love pasta salad because I love pasta and I love salad. But hey, pasta salad in my mind, I don't know when it hurt me the first time, but I've never forgotten it. And I've never forgiven it.
Are you thinking about the macaroni salad with the pieces of hard carrot in it, the mayo-y one? I totally agree. It's pasta salad should be the most delicious thing at your picnic or your barbecue. But so often it's weirdly sweet and kind of gloppy and thick, and the pasta's really mushy.
That's my thing. And I kind of feel like I don't know if there's a way around it because you've cooked the pasta already. And then you dress it, and it gets mushier and mushier.
Right. We posed the goal to ourselves to create a pasta salad that was none of those things. So I can share sort of what we came up with.
Right on.
So the first thing was not using a mayo base. And so when I first tested the recipe, I tried just a really bright vinaigrette. And another thing that happened that I realized was that when you eat the pasta cold, a lot of those flavors are muted. So you have to make sort of a punchier, more acidic, more flavorful dressing than maybe you're used to using, and more heavily seasoned. So we went with a dressing that's sort of based on romesco. It uses garlic and toasted walnuts and just jarred roasted peppers that are all blended together with olive oil and some lemon juice. And that's nice because it gives body and substance to the sauce like you would get with mayo, but that doesn't have that same heaviness. So another tip is dress the pasta salad with half the dressing if you're going to make it in advance because you need to take it somewhere. And then only right before a serving, add the rest of the dressing and toss it through. Because you're right, it does continue to absorb all of those flavors in the dressing. And so it can get almost dry.
Yeah.
So I have here everything ready to go. I'm just going to finish tossing everything together. So I have the pasta that's half dressed, the remainder of the dressing, some parm, some chopped tomatoes. So we figured this is summertime, it's getting into prime tomato season, and we wanted that other sort of very fresh element that was going to add sort of juiciness and something kind of bright. So I have a bunch of chopped tomato. We pulled out some of the walnuts from the dressing and chopped those up. So the idea here was just to create something with a lot of texture, a lot of different flavors, and finally some toasted breadcrumbs. So, and the key here was just kind of cooking the pasta al dente and not letting it get too mushy. So I'm going to put everything together and then you'll taste it and let me know what you think.
Okay.
So another thing with this was using a shape of pasta that was less prone to overcooking.
Okay.
Not farfalle. People, I think, really love farfalle.
What's the deal with bow tie pasta salad?
No, my mom always made a bow tie pasta salad that I actually really like, but it does kind of always turn a little mushy. So what we ended up going with is a very large fusilli, that sort of classic corkscrew shape, because it holds the sauce really well. And so you have all these other kind of crunchy things like the chopped walnuts and the breadcrumbs that are going to get caught in those coils. So it just holds everything really well. love and it. It doesn't, you know,
and you're
it's
using
not
like
as
novelty side fusilli. Like this is like
yeah.
fusilli the size of like my thumb.
Yes, this was a special this was a special item. But you could use regular fusilli or any okay. other kind of shape that you like. So these are some nice heirloom tomatoes. And now I'm gonna grab some basil.
Great.
And I think the basil is important because it just gives more brightness, that sort of like earthy herbal flavor. That's really nice. You know, you're in summer, so the kind of tomato basil combination is classic.
Sure. Just these big, beautiful leaves of basil thrown right in.
Yeah. So then everything's mixed together.
Yeah.
I'm just going to top with more of these breadcrumbs.
Just like handfuls of toasted breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
Like not even tasting it. I think I feel it because it's like, okay, the pasta itself, it's going to be cooked ahead of time. But if the problem with pasta salad is mush, you're adding the crunchy breadcrumbs and you're adding the crunchy nuts and you're adding all these different layers of texture. So like it kind of distracts you from
right.
the fact that...
We're definitely hedging with
yeah.
this recipe. Is that good?
Come on. That's really good. That's legit.
Mission accomplished.
That's delicious.
But it's very bright. You know, there's mm-hmm. a lot of acid. And there's also, I love raw garlic, especially in summertime. So there is some raw garlic blended into the dressing that's really kind of a really assertive flavor there.
Yeah. Well, I love your idea of first dressing it and then redressing it again.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're right, because you can taste the dressing in the pasta, because it's absorbed in the pasta, but having that other layer of fresh dressing on top.
Right, and I think there's a good proportion here of sort of like dressing and other elements to pasta. It's not swimming in it, but it's also not, you know, it's not too dry, and it's, it doesn't feel like there's, you know, just pasta there.
This is wonderful. I feel healed.
Oh, good.
The next thing you're going to show us is charred beans.
Yeah, so we took as inspiration for this whole sort of side recipe story, those classic barbecue sides that you see all the time. So like the three bean salad was kind of the inspiration for this recipe. And we did a sort of a riff on like braised collards in the story as well. But this recipe I really like because it's so, so straightforward. And there's a really, I love the method for cooking the beans, which is just to broil them. Mm. So you get a little bit of a char on the beans and they cook through. And then it's really just a matter of putting together a really simple sort of olive oil dressing. So I already pulled the strings off of 1.5 pounds total of snap peas, snow peas, and green beans.
Okay.
You can also use wax beans, any combination works. And I toss them with a couple tablespoons of olive oil. So I just want to season these with a little more salt.
Okay.
So I'm going to toss these together.
Very good tossing.
This is the best way to do it. Bean
they're
down.
Just flying, they're arcing
flying all over the place.
The
So then I have my broiler is heated and I have the rack in the oven right at the very top underneath the broiler. So I've just spread these in more or less an even layer. It's a large volume. But I like this method of cooking because some of them stay sort of crunchy and some of them get a little bit softer. And so
yeah,
I like
so
that, that mix of texture.
The texture.
Right.
Cool.
So these are going to go in the oven.
And you really have a rack set like right on
oh,
the
oh yeah, drawer. I knew you guys were coming, so it's been heating for about an hour. So
put those beans in a flaming inferno.
Right, and in this kitchen we have big hoods, so a lot of times we don't smell things as they're cooking, but if you're at home, you'll definitely know when they start to be done. But because I always forget when I put things in the oven, I'm going to set a timer. Just about 2 minutes, especially because this has been heating for a long time. And then while those are charring and cooking through, I have here in a little saucepan about 1/3 cup of oil, 1/2 teaspoon of cumin seed, some really coarsely ground black pepper, about 3/4 teaspoon, and 2 dried arbol chilies.
Nice.
And then I'm just going to add some aromatics. I have 6 cloves of garlic. I'm just going to smash those to get them out of the skin. I was thinking about one of the ways I really love to eat green beans is like in Szechuan restaurants with the sort of like Szechuan peppercorns and all of that. I like that heat.
Yeah.
So that the idea kind of started there for this recipe.
Oh, cool.
So I have these really sort of flavorful elements that I'm going to infuse into the oil.
Garlic,
yeah. And that cumin too. So I'm going to put those in there and turn on this burner. And I also have some ginger that I'm going to slice.
Mm. Just skin on.
Skin on. This is organic ginger, so I don't feel like I have to take off the peel. Although it is really easy with a spoon just to take that off. So I thinly sliced that, sort of like a 2-inch piece of ginger. And I'll dump in the rest of the garlic. And I'm just trying to swirl this, and as the oil heats up, I'll start to sizzle all those spices.
Nice. This is like a serious infusion too. It's not just, oh, a little bit of garlic and a little bit of spice and a ton of oil. This is like really, like a lot of ginger, a lot of garlic, a lot of spices. So you're really going to do like a super flavor packed oil.
Yeah, it packs a lot of flavor because, as I said, as those things kind of sit out at room temperature, it's, you know, it doesn't have the same flavor impact that something is when it's hot. Okay, there goes the timer. I'm going to double check on those beans.
Right on.
And this is starting to sizzle, so that's a good sign. Here, you keep an eye on that.
I'll keep an eye on your oil, and I will just sit here and take this ginger garlic steam bath. I hear it's good for the skin.
These are looking good.
Oh, right on. It really was just a couple minutes.
Yeah. Because we're not under the hood, it's starting to smell really good, too.
Yeah, this is...
all good stuff. And then I have here also the juice of one lime and a little bit of maple syrup. So I'm kind of creating like a little bit of a vinaigrette here with all these different elements, the acid, the oil, and just the maple. Yeah, just for that balance.
Oh, God. If you're ever in a bad mood, just put yourself in front of a boiling pot of olive oil, ginger, and garlic.
So this looks about done. I tend to look for the garlic getting golden and the ginger kind of starts to curl around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going to add, after that cools down for just a second, a little bit, just a teaspoon of maple syrup.
Okay.
And you could use brown sugar or honey, just a little bit to give us some sweetness to it, as well as that lime juice. So this is still sizzling, and that lime juice will cool this down pretty quickly.
Right.
So now it's really that simple, and I'm just going to spread out the beans on a platter because they've cooled off. So if you're doing this ahead of time and you're going to bring it somewhere, you can do all of this and just throw the oil in a jar and the beans in like a container. Yeah, and bring it there. And so right now everything is a little bit warm, but this can sit for hours at room temperature.
Yeah.
And I'm not even really straining any of this stuff out. You can eat those garlic cloves. Yeah, I would tell people to avoid the arbol chilies, but
if
you're into it.
Adventure in your life,
right.
Go for it.
Go ahead and try.
I love that. Like the sweetness of the snap pea. You can get just a little bit of color on it. Not crazy, like dark char.
Mm-hmm.
But then with all that garlic and all that ginger and like the spices, it's delicious.
And it's flexible. If you don't like cumin, you could use coriander or another whole spice. You can follow it exactly or you can kind of riff on it depending on what you have at home.
Yeah. It's delicious. And my second bite was totally different from my first because... I got more cumin in this bite. And that bite was like more about ginger.
And the green beans are a little thicker, so they are still a little bit crunchy versus like the snap peas, which get really soft. So I like having all that variation.
God, this is so good. Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Claire Saffitz is senior food editor at Bon Appetit magazine, and I promised her that I would tell everyone that despite the fact that she did not use any mayo in her recipes for this feature, she is, in fact, a mayonnaise lover. You'll find those recipes for charred bean and pea salad and romesco pasta salad with basil and parmesan in the June-July issue of Bon Appetit and on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the chef Nunu Mendes on the art of grilling sardines and America's Test Kitchen with advice to keep us happy at the grill. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lamb. You know, fish is kind of the underdog of the summer cookout, right? I mean, you have people getting psyched for racks of ribs and charring porterhouses and... you know, grilled fish doesn't always get the love it deserves when stacked up against those things. But I'm hoping that Portuguese chef Nunu Mendes is going to get you pumped to grill the underdog of underdogs. I'm talking about sardines, not the little guys you find in the cans, but plump, fresh sardines. They're like 6 or 7 inches long. They're one of the most sustainable fish you can eat, and I swear there's almost nothing more delicious than a fat little sardine with some char on it. So, chef, it's great to have you in today.
Absolute pleasure.
We're talking about grilling food today, and I really wanted to talk with you for a couple of reasons. One, because my wife's family is Portuguese, and I have fallen in love with grilled sardines, and I want to be able to impress them next time I see them, like check out my grilled sardine style. And B, because I think, you know, sardines, mackerel, these small, rich, silvery fish are incredibly delicious, and I think people are intimidated by them. But I think the Portuguese have truly... taken the appreciation of sardines and mackerel to, you know, to the utmost extent, right? So I think you guys really know what you're doing with these tiny
Absolutely.
Fish.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, mackerel and sardines are so ingrained in our culture and our food culture. So it's amazing.
Yeah. How do you shop for them? Because I think that's probably the first thing that trips people up, right?
Absolutely. I mean, when you're shopping, like, you can see the difference between the frozen ones and the fresh ones. And then the fresh ones is like this shimmering that you have on the fish. I mean, it really just, you know, they glow. The gills are like perfectly intact. The eyes are perfectly clear. You know, you can smell, like, there's not a smell of fish. I mean, they're quite tight. They're not like they're not flabby at all.
Oh, you want them firm.
Correct. You want very, very extremely firm. I always prefer them to be a little smaller. You know, I think they're a little sweeter, like not baby, but like, I think smaller sardines, I mean, the profile flavor of the meat is incredible. It's incredibly sweet. You know, it's an oily fish, but it's got a nice little sweetness to them.
Mm-hmm.
And a richness to them. And and again, I always find, I must say that as much as I love the way we cook them in Portugal, I feel like sometimes they might be slightly overcooked. I think it's one of the things that you have to be careful with sardines is not to overcook them. And also, you know, because they have so many bones, I mean, they are a bony fish. I mean, I think understanding where the bones are, where the bone lines are, so you can basically either score them before you grill them, or maybe, like, you know, butterfly them and then put them back on. And if you grill them a little under, like, the meat is like just perfect, you know. You always want to salt them really heavily. And the salt, what it does, like, you know, when it hits the grill, it creates this beautiful steam, draws the moisture from the fish, creates this beautiful steam. It also creates almost like a little barrier so the meat doesn't stick as it draws some of the moisture from the fish as well. So rock salt, Maldon salt. I mean, you know, in Portugal, we use sea salt
all
the time.
Big flaky salt.
Correct, yeah.
And you salt it right before you put it on the grill.
I salt them a little bit before putting them on the grill, and then hit them on a really hot grill. Make sure you find the hottest spot on the grill to give them a really nice hard sear, and then just bring them down. Once they're marked and not, you know, like, they don't stick, you transfer them to a cooler part of the grill. Let them ride for a couple of minutes, and then just take them off. I mean, they cook so quickly, and you want to have a little bit of tension, you know, when you bite into the meat. So you definitely want to wait. You don't want them to be super overcooked. I mean, scaling them, you know. I think a lot of people in Portugal don't scale them, but it becomes very hard to navigate through it. But so I do recommend you scale them first.
Okay.
And I must say that from personal experience, and this is something very interesting, when I was actually doing the book, I was actually cooking the sardines in this grill in this rooftop in Lisbon, and we're reasonably close to the seafront, to the riverfront, and so I left the sardines, like, you know, with a little bit of salt. Outside in a tray, and like, we had seagulls come in and they started like actually munch. Basically, I went inside. Yeah, like, exactly. So, like, this is a key. If you're by the sea and you're cooking sardines, just watch for the seagulls. So
even the Portuguese seagulls know how good your grilled sardines are.
Absolutely. Like, come on. Like, you know, it's a charcoal. You got a charcoal going, you got sardines. Like, this is perfect. They're like, they just sit around. They wait for the sucker to go into the flat, and like, that's it. Attack strategy. It worked. So yeah, so they stole my sardines. Yeah, so it's pretty funny.
That's incredible. Well, yeah, let me ask one more question about the grill.
Sure.
Do you treat the grill in a particular way? I know a lot of chefs like to, you know, oil a rag and then rub the oil onto the grill. Do you do anything like that to make sure it doesn't stick?
I try not to oil the grill or oil the sardines. I prefer not to. I mean, like, you know, maybe just a touch of oil on the sardines, or just rub a little bit of oil. Mm-hmm. Just on the part where you're about to grill them, but you don't want to go. I mean, you know, if you put too much oil on the grill, obviously it's going to burn, and it's going to smoke up or flame up. And again, if you do the same to the fish, you have the same result. So you want to try to go as hot as possible. And yeah, like, and don't flip them too early, because if you do, you know, like, you need to achieve like a good sear on that.
Mm-hmm. And when you flip them, do you like to use like a spatula to sort of lift them off, or do you use tongs or?
I prefer little spatulas, you know. I always prefer spatulas. I mean, I think tongs are like, they're not delicate enough, you know. Like, yeah. And they think they're too harsh. They bruise the fish too much. I prefer to use something that is delicate, just as delicate as the fish.
And how do you like to serve them? I mean, assuming you can get to them before the birds do.
the seagulls do, yes.
Yeah, because usually in the traditional Portuguese styles, usually they're just served straight grilled, right? Maybe with a piece of lemon. But do you like to pair them with garnishes or sauces?
Yeah. So one of the typical things in Portugal is to serve them with a roasted green pepper salad. Mm. And it's very traditional as well. When you get a really, really good, you know, a very good quality rustic bread, you basically, you rest them on the bread. So the oils from the sardines, that juiciness, that salt, all that stuff just goes into the bread.
Oh,
so
great.
My favorite way to eat sardines, I mean, you know, talking about rustic without getting too fancy about it, just salt them really well, drop them on the grill, and then on the side you get some green peppers, and on the same grill you just grill them really hard on all sides, large mm-hmm. green peppers, good quality green peppers,
like sweet peppers.
Yeah, like bell peppers, you know. I mean, okay. That's what you call them in the U.S., I believe. So bell peppers, you basically grill them on all sides, take them out and transfer them to a bowl, just, you know, cover them, let them steam so you can take the skin out. Mm-hmm. And then once the skin is out, julienne the, you know, just slice, you know, thick slices or coarse slices or strips of the peppers that should be well roasted, well grilled.
Yeah, soft.
Yeah. And then... Yeah, I mean, I like to get white onions. Like, I know in the U.S. you use a lot of Maui onions, like, so the really sweet onions, mm-hmm. or Vidalia onions or something like that. Like, so something like a nice white sweet onion that you can eat raw. You mm-hmm. slice that paper thin, julienne as well. Again, you can drop them on the grill if they're too hard, or just, I like them raw. Then marinate them with a little lemon juice, a little bit of salt. You can do some slivers of garlic if you want, if you're into, like, harsh garlic or not. Extra virgin olive oil, lots of salt. And then we use like a little bit of marjoram, bit of marjoram on top. But you can use basil as well, which is nice. It's not as Portuguese. I mean, marjoram is more Portuguese than basil, I guess. And so we serve that on the side. A couple of wedges of lemon, some piti-piti, so some chili oil if you want, or some a good splash of olive oil over the whole thing. On the, like, you know, I like to rest my sardines. The moment they come out of the grill, I just like to rest them on the bread, on a big, thick slice of country bread. Maybe it could be slightly grilled or not. If you want to get fancy, you can rub a little garlic and olive oil on the bread and then drop the sardines right on top and let them cool down there and then start eating them from there.
Yeah, you know, and all those juices. It's really nice.
Exactly. So you carve all, you basically, you start eating the sardines, right? And then at the end of it, you know, you remove all the bones and then you wind up with all this lovely bread that's got like all the sardine flavor, and then you eat the bread after. It's very nice. So this is it. Yeah.
That sounds
good. Yeah.
I can't wait to see my in-laws.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chef.
Show them that trick. I think it'll be a pleasure. Yeah. I think they'll be stoked for that.
All right. This is great. Thank you so much, Chef.
Absolute pleasure.
Nuno Mendes is the author of the beautiful new cookbook, My Lisbon. You can find his recipe for grilled sardines with green peppers at splendidtable.org. So did that work? Like, are you itching to grill sardines now? Well, either way, whatever you grill and whatever kind of grill you grill on, you should listen to our next interview. It's between our producer Sally Swift and America's Test Kitchen's Dan Souza on some of the basic skills of the grill. You know, little things like how to not make a fireball with lighter fluid. And some of the surprising differences between cooking with charcoal and gas. Have a listen.
Hey, Dan, great to have you.
Hey, it's good to be here.
So we have been talking about eating outside this whole hour, and I have come to you for a guide to grilling. I know that you have many opinions, and you guys have done a lot of research on this one. So I kind of want to start with some of the mistakes that people make when they're grilling. And I am wondering if you can kind of lead us through some of those.
Sure thing. Yeah, do you have specific questions, or you want to talk about some common mistakes?
Let's talk about some common mistakes, and then I do have a few issues of my own I'd like to clear up.
All right. So I think, you know, what happens is a lot of people, they only grill when it's warm out. So a whole year goes by and then they fall into some bad habits or never really knew to start with kind of best practices. And so there's a few places that, you know, it's not hard to do it right, but it's easy to go wrong. So I think the first one is if you're using a charcoal grill and you want to get it lit really quickly, which a lot of people do, a lot of people reach for lighter fluid. And, you know, it seems like a good option. You know, you spray it on the coals, light the mask to it. You had a big old ball of flames and it's lit. But when we've done tests with using lighter fluid and using the self-starting charcoal, And we actually find that, you know, a lot of it burns off, but you can get some residual flavor, especially if you're cooking some really mild tasting food on there, that you can get some residual flavor from it. So we really recommend moving away from lighter fluid. And there's another great option out there, and it's using a chimney starter. So these are...
You can find them anywhere, right?
That's right. And they're not that expensive, and they last a really long time, and they're really great.
And how do you know, here's one of my questions, is how do you know when the coals are ready? Because I do use a chimney starter. Are they should they totally be white, or are there flames coming out at the top?
So yeah, you shouldn't see any flames anymore. You'll see flames early in the process and lots of smoke, and that will subside. And then when they're ready to go, they should have a light dusting of white ash over the top.
So you have to wait.
Yeah, if they're still black, then they're not quite ready. That light coating of ash, and you'll see that they'll sink down a little bit into the chimney. That's when they're ready to go. If you'd up earlier, you do potentially risk the fire going out or just not heating very evenly. So you want a light layer of ash on top, and you're ready to go.
Okay, can you walk us through kind of general fire setup?
Yeah, so we generally use three different setups when we're, you know, really when we're talking about either charcoal or gas. There's kind of a, you know, an analogy between the two. But so let's start with charcoal. And the three setups are a single level fire, and that's when we have the coals poured over the entire surface in an even layer. And that's really good for when you want to kind of char and cook at the same time. So, you know, smaller pieces of food, like if you were cooking sausages or maybe boneless, skinless chicken breasts, where you're basically getting some good char on the outside, but you're also cooking through at a moderate rate. That's a single level fire.
All right.
If you have a bigger piece of food where you need to cook kind of gently to cook it all the way through the center, but you also want to do some searing and get some char, that would be a two level fire. So what you'd want to do is pour the entire chimney into half of the grill. And so you have these two zones. You have a very hot zone and you have a cool indirect zone. So what you can do is start your bone-in chicken breasts on the cool side, nice and indirect heat, cook them until they're almost all the way cooked through, and then you simply move them over to the hot side and kind of sear and char. And that's a good technique for anything where the food is a little bit larger and you need those two different heat levels.
Okay.
And then the final one is what we call our concentrated fire, and this is corralling the coals into a small area. And sometimes we use a disposable aluminum roasting pan where we cut the bottom out of it just as kind of a corral, and we put a full chimney of coals right in that, and then we cook directly over it. And this is where you're cooking foods like steaks and burgers, where you want a big disparity between the outside and the inside. So for a steak, we're looking for a really good sear on the outside, tons of char, and the inside we want to be about, you know, 125 degrees or medium rare. So we want that disparity, and that's a great technique.
Okay, and tell me about the lid. When do you use the lid, and when don't you use the lid?
To lid or not to lid? That's a big question when it comes to grilling.
Seems kind of basic, but I really am kind of stumped all the time about that.
Yeah, no, it's a really great question, and it actually does matter. So if you're working on a gas grill, generally speaking, they don't have the output of a charcoal grill. So a lot of times we recommend keeping the lid down when you're using a gas grill. You never want to light a gas grill with the lid down because it can trap gas in there and cause some problems there. But so you want to light it with the lid open. But for the most part, when you're cooking with a gas grill, you want the lid to be down.
Okay.
And that's going to make it a little bit hotter inside. Actually, the opposite is really true when you're working with a charcoal grill, because that's all about airflow. So if you have the lid off of a charcoal grill, you have a lot more air rushing through there, so it's going to burn even hotter. So what you want to do is, if you're cooking something like a burger and steak, you know, where you, again, want a really hot fire, you want to cook with the lid off. If you are cooking something that is going to go lower and slower, such as barbecue, such as, you know, indirect for a roast that you're going to sear, you want to cook with the lid on.
So actually the lid on in charcoal is actually slowing things down.
Yes, exactly. The lid on with charcoal is slowing things down. And what that actually leads us into is another really good point, is when you're working with charcoal, you have these grill vents. And
my next question, how did you know?
Oh, really? Yeah. So, you know, I think a lot of people are confused as to what to do with these grill vents, what they're for. And they're really cool because they actually have a huge impact on the temperature of your grill. As I mentioned, airflow is really what controls your fire with the charcoal grill. So if you have the grill vents and they're located on the bottom of the grill and on the top, if you have them completely open, you're getting more air through and your grill will be hotter. If you start to close them down, maybe a halfway or three quarters of the way, you will actually cool the fire down. If you close them all the way, you risk actually putting the fire out because there's no more airflow.
And you do have to clean out the ash from the bottom of the vent, I'm assuming then.
Yes. So cleaning is a big thing and definitely starts with that ash bucket. If it's really, really jammed up in there, it's going to restrict airflow, definitely. You also, if you have a grease trap in a gas grill, you want to actually open that up and look in there and make sure that it's cleaned out. If you have a lot of grease buildup and you have a fire in there, it can actually cause a big grease fire that can be dangerous and is definitely inconvenient.
Okay, that makes sense. I have a question about, when you want something really charred when you're cooking on a charcoal fire, I've seen people have oil bottles next to them and kind of squirt the flames to get the flames up. Does that work?
Oof, that's a dicey thing.
Okay.
So there's a little bit of danger in that, and just in, you're putting oil on a fire and it's very, very flammable. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it's not really a great idea. A little bit of flare-ups, we call it a flare-up when you see a fire on a grill like that, a little bit can be good. So if you have, say, a burger cooking over the coals and a little bit of fat and juices strips down and sets off a tiny little flame, just a little one, that's actually vaporizing the oil and the juices. And a lot of that flavor can come up and actually stick back to the food, providing a lot of really nice grill flavor. But that's a very, very small little flare up. We do have kind of a cool technique that I will mention where we're cooking a beef tenderloin and it's on the cooler side of the grill. And then on the hotter side, we have one or two pieces of bacon that we've kind of scrunched up on a skewer, and that's sitting over kind of just over the hotter side of the grill. And as that starts to cook and render, you get those little drops of fat and juices that kind of flare up and do provide a nice kind of smoky, nice flavor to the tenderloin. But I would say that's the exception to the rule.
That's a sneaky recipe.
Yeah, it is.
I'm so happy to be cooking outside again.
Oh, me too. I've been waiting months and months for this.
Hey, Dan, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Allie.
Dan Souza is editor-in-chief of Cooks Illustrated, and you can find the recipe for mojo marinated skirt steak on our website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, if there's a kid in your life who loves to cook, or maybe just a kid who loves to eat, well, our friends at Brains On, which is the science podcast for kids, teamed up with America's Test Kitchen on a special series about the science of cooking. They explore questions like, what makes a good knife cut well, and what's the scientifically best way to whisk something, and microwaves. How do they work? Each episode will include a recipe you and your kids can make together, and you can hear it all at brainson.org, or you can find Brains On wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, I'll be taking your calls, and we'll talk to Bill Kim, master of Kung Fu Barbecue. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I am so ready to talk to you. So pick up your phone, give me a call, 1-800-537-5252. And let's get to it. We have Karen from Clarksville, Tennessee, calling. Hey, Karen, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I have an outdoor cooking question. I am the grub master for a Cub Scout pack here in Tennessee, pack 503. Okay. We have about 50 active boys, and we go camping 4 to 5 times a year.
Okay.
We're pretty good at cooking outside in Dutch ovens, but last year we tried a traditional Thanksgiving dinner outside, and the boys cooked all of the sides. And we did creamed corn and cheesy potatoes. We had 2 different kinds of stuffing. They ate Brussels sprouts, sweet potatoes, and pumpkin pie and apple crisp.
Wait, all that you cooked outside in Dutch ovens?
Yes.
Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty awesome to see them do it.
Remind me, what are the ages of Cub Scouts typically?
Cub Scouts are kindergarten through 5th grade boys and their families.
Oh, man. A small battalion of 5 to 10-year-olds cooking all that food in Dutch ovens outside.
Yes.
And you made it happen, and it was happy and delicious, and you still have a question.
I still have a question. Yeah.
I am not qualified to answer anything if you can get that to happen.
Well, we have some really awesome leaders and some really awesome kids.
Wow, so cool. All right, sorry, so what was the question?
So we chickened out and did turkey loaf because I had ovens at the camp, which it doesn't always happen, but mm-hmm. I want some ideas on how to cook turkeys outside. Everybody agreed they wanted to try it again this year, but they would like real turkey.
Oh, okay. What you're saying to me makes me wonder, and boy, this would be so cool.
Mm-hmm.
But would you consider building essentially like a rotisserie?
Okay.
And by that I mean like It could be pretty simple. You'd build a metal stand with a metal rod, and doing the turkeys rotisserie style over the charcoal fire.
Okay.
And
okay.
Because I think if you're thinking Dutch oven, you can get that to work for sure. I'm sure you can bake them, but then, you know, it'll be steaming inside the Dutch oven. You can get it cooked and you'll probably get it super delicious. But, you know, you're not going to, if people are thinking like, we want the turkey for that golden skin, that golden bird kind of feeling, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm sure you can Google up a million and one books on how to build a sort of primitive rotisserie and just get those turkeys roasting. You can do it with a crank. You know, you can sort of crank them slowly, and it would be fun to watch them as they get, you know, progressively more and more beautifully colored. Keep them a fair distance away from the flame so that you're not overcooking or you're not burning the skin. Give it that time to cook all the way through and just get that going for a few hours. Maybe that's the first thing you do while, you know, everyone's prepping everything else. And that could be an idea.
That could be
the
early afternoon project.
Yeah.
I'll go for a hike.
Yeah, and how magnificent would that look if you have, you know, four or five of these big, beautiful birds just kind of roasting along, and you would just feel so cool doing that, I think. Or the other way to do it is kind of, this might sound like more involved than that, but in some ways is easier, where maybe you do also then, you know, cook those turkeys in big Dutch ovens, basically bake them till they're done. And afterwards, maybe you can set up that rotisserie as well, and then just brown them afterwards. Like almost like if you were roasting in the oven, you roast, you know, some recipes you roast at the low temperature and you crank it up to brown the skin in the end. You can control the cooking a little bit more, make sure they're cooked all the way through. It's maybe a little bit safer. It's like adding a step to it, but maybe you can do that and still get that nice skin at the end. Or, you know, you can also do it, and if you have grills, you know, bake the turkeys in the Dutch oven, take them out, and then just give them a little time on the grill at the end just to help brown up some of that skin.
Yeah, I may have to practice this summer so that we can do it this fall.
You are running a superior Cub Scout grub operation, I have to say.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, some parents have some hard times on the first morning when I say just get your cup of coffee and let them crack the eggs, and you've got 10 boys cracking 6 dozen eggs. But they get so excited, and they get involved, and they try things that they've never tried before, and they know that they can do it.
That's super cool. One of my early, like, formative cooking experiences was camping and cooking outdoors and thinking like, oh, this is really cool. I want to go home and do more of this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for the call, and good luck with the turkeys, and congratulations already for feeding Cub Scouts at a superior level.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Thanks for the call.
All right. Thank you.
All right. We have Mark on the line from Huntsville, Alabama. Hey, Mark, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I've been cooking more Eastern Asian cuisine recently.
Uh-huh.
And I've heard many great things about miso paste and how it really enhances dishes, in particular, roasted vegetables. However, personally, I've had no luck in using miso paste in most of my roasting exploits.
What's gone wrong?
Well, I've usually just been tossing the vegetables with a red miso paste-based sauce, and it leads to a lot of burnt miso and unevenly cooked vegetables.
Yeah. Okay. Do you like the flavor of the miso?
I do. The red miso is a bit strong for a lot of vegetables, but things such as sweet potatoes, it works very well with.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, you can certainly try with the experiment with other misos. Red miso is a little bit of a more intense one. You can get like a white miso that's a little bit more chill, a little bit more mellow, and maybe, you know, it's a little friendlier with a wider variety of things. But I would say, I think the problem is in tossing it with the miso before you cook. Because miso certainly does cook well, but it can burn pretty quickly. There's a lot of protein in it, a lot of like natural sugars in it, a lot of starches in it. And especially if you're roasting vegetables, you know, you're probably doing it at a fairly high heat. You're probably going to roast them for 20, 25 minutes to get them cooked through and tender. So I would be afraid of finding that exact balance where you can actually roast them with the miso. So what I would suggest is go ahead and roast those vegetables like you normally would. I don't know how you do it, but I like to use salt, pepper, and oil. Take them out and then toss them with your miso. You said you're doing it with a sauce, so maybe you're already cutting the miso with some vinegar or something like that to like make it a little bit thinner and more spreadable.
Absolutely. Vinegar and mirin, usually.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. So yeah, toss your cooked vegetables in that as a dressing, and I think you're going to really love that. You won't have to worry about the burnt miso, and your vegetables will be cooked the way you like them.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. I'll have to give that a try.
And once you get that nailed down, you can experiment a little bit with like maybe pulling the vegetables. They're almost ready, but not quite, you know, like 5 minutes before you would normally pull them. tossing with the miso then, and then putting it back on your sheet pan or whatever, spread it all out and cook it that way so you can get a little bit of the, you know, caramelized, charred flavor in the miso, but not, you know, burn it all the way out. You know what I mean? So you can play with that later on.
That sounds delicious.
But I would maybe experiment first with just use it as a dressing. I think you're really going to like that.
Will do, Francis. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks for the call, Mark. Take care.
Sadly to say, that is all the time we have for calls for today. But I love it when you call us with questions. 1-800-537-5252 or Twitter or Facebook, or you can email us contact@splendidtable.org. Bill Kim made his name as a hardcore fine dining chef. He ran the kitchen at the legendary Charlie Trotter's, which was one of the first tasting menu restaurants in America, and where, you know, he had an army of cooks who were tweezing delicate flower petals onto your dish or whatever. But since he left that world, he's dug into two things. One, the Asian flavors he grew up with, and two, boiling his cooking down to simple sauces that pack tons of flavor, so anyone can make delicious food without a brigade of cooks. He's got a book out called Korean Barbecue, and we talked about why he wrote it to give away all his secrets right up front.
You know, when people cook Asian food, it's you buy a whole bunch of ingredients and you cook Asian one day, and 2 days after, you still have the same ingredients. And so the idea was to let Asian be a part of your daily routine. You know, cook a chicken, you might want to take a little bit of the master sauce and add it to something that you already do. So let these sauces kind of enhance your cooking.
Yeah, I think a lot of cookbooks start with like, here's the pantry you should build before you start cooking these recipes. And a lot of times like, oh, that sounds great, that sounds great. And you're like 6 days into cooking these different like condiments and sauces or whatever. And then you're like, oh, I'm going to use that twice in my life. So yeah. I love the fact that like you boil it down to 10 items and then literally every recipe uses those things. So it really is like, this is really your pantry. This is really going to be like your palate you can draw from. So what I'd love to do with you, since we are right in grilling season, I think it would be really fun if we walk through a couple of these sauces or seasonings and you can kind of help us think about how to use it.
Sure. Let's do it. Let's do it. I can't wait.
I'm going to test you on your own book is what's going to happen right
okay.
now.
You didn't know I have a book in front of me.
Oh, yeah, it was an open book test. You're cheating. Okay, the first one I really want to talk to you about is, well, because the book is called Korean Barbecue, is the Korean barbecue sauce. I think it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's Korean barbecue and there's barbecue sauce. But like Korean barbecue doesn't really have barbecue sauce, right? So what's the deal?
It doesn't. But, you know, it's the whole idea of when you make the marinade, the Korean barbecue marinade, you're always going to have a little bit left. You're like, what do I do with this stuff? You know, you might have plain yogurt that's in your refrigerator. You might have a vegetable spread or something that you could add. And that's just me coming from my childhood. One of the things that I used to do, and I can't believe I'm telling everybody, my dad used to have, what is that? Aqua Velva in the bathroom. I used to lock myself in the bathroom and play like a mixologist, but with shaving cream, cologne, mouthwash, and toothpaste. And that's how I got started. I'm like, let's see what I could concoct and make. And I feel the same kind of way. The Korean barbecue marinade, when you add yogurt, these are two tenderizers. And when you add it to a chicken, it becomes this sweet and sour that goes well together. But it's melding of two different things. And if you're eating Korean barbecue, you also eat it with samjang. You also add kimchi to it. So you could also blend that marinade with the things that you're going to eat.
Yeah. So your recipe for it is sugar, soy sauce, onion, pear, kiwi, garlic, ginger, and sesame oil. And then you literally just blend them together in a blender. So now you're saying use that as a marinade. You can mix it with yogurt and that becomes its own sauce. You can...
Yes.
Mix it with, like you said, gochujang, which is the Korean fermented chili paste. So there are all these like Korean like mother sauces, flavor enhancers you can add it to and use as your sauce later. How else would you riff on the Korean barbecue sauce if you had like a jar of it in front of you? What else could you do with it?
Well, I think
if you're cooking on, let's say, a grill or oven or a saute pan, you could actually, you know, baste it. Instead of just letting it marinate, it becomes a glaze and a sauce, and you're accenting the flavor right at the end, so it kind of glistens on a piece of chicken or a salmon or a pork. So you're kind of building the flavors on top of letting it sit in the marinade, but it also becomes the sauce as it cooks and reduces and it chars. So, you know, that's a great way to impart those delicious flavors.
Oh, right on. Let's go to another one. You have curry salt. And this is equal parts curry powder and salt with a little Japanese chili powder. How do you use that?
Well, putting salt on something, it's great. But I like to add another taste, you know, having the turmeric, having a little cumin in the curry powder, and just you could season fries, chips, even fish, chicken. Mm-hmm. It's just, why add just salt? Add other items that have salty elements to it. So it just adds in parts that, like, you know, aromatic, earthy characteristics of curry and a little bit of spice. You know, when you're grilling vegetables, since curry is dissolvable in a little bit of oil, so add a little bit of olive oil, you know, take your asparagus and just be able to season it, and it just the flavor just penetrates into the vegetable very well.
Oh, I love that. Let's go to another one. It's Co-Rican sauce, and it's got paprika, oregano, chili powder, curry powder, salt, vinegar, olive oil, and like a megaton of garlic. What's the deal with this sauce? What is Co-Rican sauce, first of all?
So I'm Korean. My wife is Puerto Rican, and we call ourselves Co-Rican. So, and she, by the way, she does not cook. She admits it, but her mom is a great cook. And once she met me, she wanted to kind of show me some Puerto Rican recipes. And this is one of her famous marinades. Her name is Lola. So Lola showed me how to take vinegar and use that being part of a sauce and help to kind of tenderize meat and also impart flavors. And, you know, garlic, oregano, curry powder. To me, that was foreign. But as I tasted her food, I'm just like, man, this is like kind of like Korean food because you impart like haunting flavors.
So you just take all those, again, all those ingredients and in a blender, and then you've got this stuff. How do you use it? What are some things you would riff on?
First and foremost, it's used as the base to create other things. So, in, you know, it's an enhancer, and be able to start with something super, super flavorful, then you add and subtract to what you do. You know, for turkey, it's a marinade for turkey. We call it, for our Thanksgiving, we call it lechon turkey. So we so there's only four of us. So every year we only get three turkey tenderloins. And it's so delicious. And we don't have to brine. We don't have to let it sit for, you know, 10 hours. We put the Co-Rican and marinade on there. 4 hours, just let it go. Then let it cook. Within probably 45 minutes, we have turkey ready to go.
So I love it. I love that you can use it on its own, but then, like you say in the book, you can use this Co-Rican sauce to add to other sauces like Nook Cham, which is the Vietnamese fish sauce, lime, sugar, chili, garlic dip that you get with, like, you know, your spring rolls and stuff like that. And you can mix it together with that and create a whole new sauce with it. I love this sort of, like, you know, building block type of cooking where you can have these things in front of you. You have your curry salt, you have your Co-Rican sauce, and then it's just, you can just mix and match and, you know, dunk in chicken or dunk in pork, let it marinate, sear it, grill it, and finish off with it. And you can have like 1,000 combinations.
Yeah.
Cool. This is so great, Chef. Thank you so much. I can't wait to get grilling.
Well, thank you. Great talking to you.
Bill Kim is the author of Korean Barbecue, Master Your Grill in 7 Sauces. And you can find his recipes for Co-Rican sauce, Korean barbecue sauce, and curry salt at splendidtable.org. And that's our show for the week. I highly recommend going through Bill's book and just making a bunch of those sauces at the beginning of the book and just like putting them on everything. That's what I did, and it has made my life that much better. So thank you for spending the time with us, and I hope you are inspired to start planning your dream cookout. And until next week, eat well, drink well, and please tip well. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. Thank you to everyone who's contributed and made this show possible, and we literally could not do it without you. To help support our show, just head to splendidtable.org, where, by the way, you will find information on all of our guests and a whole lot of recipes and ideas for summer cooking. You should also sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's all about simplifying your cooking life midweek. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our associate producer. Chip Walton is our digital producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.